Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. There are more calls for a ceasefire or some kind of negotiated settlement of the Ukraine conflict. Some NATO leaders have warned Zelensky will have to make some difficult decisions. However, the West has little interest in Russia's plan to restore the peace. That plan is in plain view. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in St. Petersburg, we cross to Alexander Atom. He is a senior lecturer at St. Petersburg State Institute of Technology. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. George, as I said in my introduction, the whole focus in the Western world on this conflict in Ukraine is to somehow get a settlement that is preferential to Ukraine and, of course, to its NATO backers. But if you flip the coin, I think that it would be much easier to resolve this conflict if you took Russia's interest into consideration, and then it's never done. And that's one of the problems in moving forward, because if there is no recognition of a legitimate security interest, this is not going to end well. And it's going to end very badly, I think, for all parties involved. Go ahead.
There you summarized it perfectly, Peter. This whole conflict started precisely because Russia's security concerns had not been addressed for around 30 years, but more pertinently, for the last 8 years, while NATO, you know, as its boast, was building up Ukraine as a battleship directed at Russia. And then, of course, when President Putin issued his two draft documents for some sort of a permanent security architecture for Europe along the lines of the Helsinki Final Act of the 1970s, the Americans and then, of course, NATO just simply said that we're not interested. There isn't going to be any kind of a settlement unless Russia's security concerns are taken into account. And yet when one reads the media accounts and when one reads all these stories, well, Schultz and Macron are pushing Zelensky, well, give us one good counteroffensive. And then once this counteroffensive of yours succeeds, then we'll be ready to negotiate. I mean, but you can't negotiate anything until you understand the position of the other party. And that's why the whole, you know, Western position is so ludicrous. And this war cannot be settled unless the West simply realizes that it has to take into account what started this whole thing, namely Russia's security concerns.
Yeah, Alexander in St. Petersburg, one of the things I find very tragic, and it's kind of an impoverished way of thinking, is just as George just said, you know, give us one good offensive, you know, claw back some territory, then we'll sit down and negotiate. It is as if Russia would be even willing to do that, okay? It is assumed that Russia would do that if they were asked for it. Because the problem with the approach from the West, which is very, very poorly thought out, other than, you know, hemorrhaging Russia, which is probably the most important issue they had. This has nothing to do with Ukraine. But even if there was even a unilateral ceasefire on the part of the Ukrainians, what NATO countries would do is just, you know, rebuild up Ukraine's forces to start all over again. And there's no sane person in Moscow would allow that to happen, because they watched for 8 years how NATO built up Ukraine, and then we had this. Okay, why would they wait another 8 years? Why even wait 8 weeks? Go ahead, Alexander.
I think part of what we're seeing from the West, as we've talked about before, is that there is a split in the U.S. elites between those who support continuing this adventure in Ukraine and continuing to fund the effort and arm the effort, and those who are seeing that they're not going to accomplish the West's goals. So one thing that I thought was pretty interesting recently is Cameron Hume, who was a former ambassador from the U.S. He's come out recently criticizing Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, for his handling of international relations, particularly regarding Russia. So I don't think that sort of commentary is just random. I would think that somebody with connections like that, Hume has connections with the Council on Foreign Relations. So it looks like he's part of this effort from some people in Washington to say, look, we're not accomplishing Western interests in the Ukraine. So does it make sense to continue pouring all of this money and all of these resources into it? And I think it's a really good point that Blinken is He's not so much of a diplomat in the traditional sense. He's more of an ideologue and a political operator if you look at his career history. And that comes out in the way that he handles himself on the international stage. So he goes to meetings with the Chinese and tries to chide them about what they're doing. And he goes into meetings with the Saudis and criticizes them on their internal affairs. And he's really not making any friends with his attitude on the world stage. So he's weakening the position of the U.S. And I think that some elites in Washington are starting to get fed up with this really narrow-minded, extreme push to continue trying to fight this war in the Ukraine, regardless of what outcomes we're seeing on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, but George, Alexander brings up some very good points here. But again, the strategy, if there, you can even call it a strategy, it's more kind of a messianic crusade, ideologically driven. The entire approach the U.S. and its allies have pursued is that it's an anti-Russia policy. It's not a pro-Ukraine policy. Again, the way you've, you know, if a supposition is formed badly, you're always going to get a bad outcome. And this is what's happened in this case.
Yes, that's unquestionably the case. It's not really about Ukraine. I mean, that's why we need to sort of move away from any kind of discussion. This is about helping Ukraine. This is an effort to arm Ukraine or anything like that. It isn't about Ukraine. This is a war using Ukraine as a proxy in order to defeat once and for all Russia, with the hope that somehow, you know, Putin will be gone, he'll be overthrown, and some kind of a pro-Western puppet regime will take over in Moscow, and then essentially, you know, whatever's left of Russia will be entirely at the mercy of NATO. That's the ultimate objective. And people such as Blinken and Biden and Nuland, you know, that's how they think. That's their ideological perspective. And they're not just going to let it go. And that's why, of course, there are rational voices who say, well, that doesn't make any sense. This is a ludicrously ambitious goal that cannot succeed. But if people like that had prevailed at the beginning, we wouldn't be where we are. You know, Russia would have accomplished its goals very early on last spring and would now be enjoying a peaceful and secure present. We don't have that. Instead, you know, the United States decided to make a stand here. And that's why where we are. And I think that's why it's such a dangerous situation, because it's very difficult now for the United States to step off.
Yeah, Alexander, it's very interesting. You have to look at the sense of causation here, because there's been over the last couple of years, not an original idea, but Russia and China are moving closer together. Well, this has been going on for a long time. People suddenly wake up to it here. And so the policy is we have to knock Russia out. We're going to use Ukraine. We're going to knock them out before they get too close to China. Well, that horse left the stable a very long time ago. And now with this proxy war in Ukraine, it's only accelerated the kind of constituting an alliance, a Russian-Chinese alliance. I mean, they misunderstood what was going on, and their actions have actually created the opposite that they wanted. Alexander.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think on the international stage, you have to look at China and Russia as being one entity effectively, because they're both being encircled by NATO forces, and neither of them like it, naturally. So
they see what NATO can do, the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, the involvement in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, the list goes on and on. They have a good reason to not be happy about that. Keep going.
And economically, your point is well taken by Chinese investors who have been pulling their money out of Swiss banks because they're concerned that they're you know, their resources may be frozen in the same way that Russian assets abroad were frozen by the U.S. So the U.S. has kind of overplayed its hand. It's been so aggressive in pursuing its war against Russia that they spooked the rest of the world. People don't want to do business with a bullying regime like this. So that's also been shown by recent reconciliation efforts between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with these talks that took place recently in China. And that's also very significant, because here is China stepping into the Middle East to try and broker some agreements between parties that historically do not get along very well. And that also is going to have an effect on the situation in Israel, because Israel and Saudi Arabia for a long time have gotten along pretty well. And Saudi Arabia has refrained from criticizing their actions too heavily. So now when, you know, Iran and Israel are enemies, so with Saudi Arabia and Iran attempting to reestablish relations, that doesn't look good for Israel's influence. And there are Russian forces in Syria, which are providing a check against Israeli attacks on Hezbollah or Iranian targets in Syria. So as the U.S. and U.S. ability to influence the situation in the Middle East is declining, it's causing a decline in Israel's influence in the region as well. So to some actors in the U.S. and in Israel, it may look like the only way out of this spiral that they're finding themselves in is to push ever harder on what's going on in Ukraine. Maybe they think that if they can break the Russian military, then they can trigger the destabilization.
Yeah, Alexander, I've said this to George many times on our podcast. I always get the sense they're in the casino and it's roulette. They just keep rolling the, you know, spinning the wheel and seeing if their winning number will come up. Okay. You know, George, we have a minute before we go to the break. What is it? It's 10 rounds, 11 rounds of sanctions. If it didn't work the first round, then why, if it doesn't have the impact you want, why do you keep hunkering down? It doesn't make any sense to me, George.
No, on the question of the case, they think that they keep doing it, and eventually there will become a point at which Russia will collapse, just like Russia will supposedly collapse militarily, or Russia will run out of missiles and artillery shells, and the soldiers will mutiny, or the Russian government will collapse, Putin will be overthrown, and so the Russian economy will collapse. You know, there'll be shortages, even though they were, you know, all the UK media are reporting, you know, they're contrasting the empty shelves in the supermarkets in the UK with the full supermarkets in Russia. So they've sanctions, and we're the ones who don't have enough food, and we have the ration.
Who got sanctions in the end? Who got sanctions? All right, gentlemen, I have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
March 11th, 2011. The largest earthquake ever recorded in Japan is registered. A 14-meter tsunami devastates the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant.
Sono nel centro di Tokyo, da Kasaka. C'è un terremoto fortissimo, tutti i palazzi stanno muovendosi.
The nuclear reactors are flooded, sparking an horrific disaster. Pio, an Italian journalist living in Japan, decides to go to the area of the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima immediately.
Non è arrivato ancora nessuno delle autorità. Sono passati tre giorni. Ecco, questa è la situazione di questo.
Ecco, siamo arrivati a 2 chilometri dalla centrale di Fukushima, quella che sta facendo preoccupare il Giappone e tutto il resto del mondo.
A 4-year investigation starts. Watch on RT.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition to remind you we're discussing some real news. All right, let's go back to Georgia and Budapest. Georgia, I said in my introduction that Russia's plan for restoring peace is in plain view. And we go back to December 17th, 2021, when Russia sent to NATO and to the United States its proposals, basically recognizing the indivisibility of security, NATO expansion, and Russia's role, Russia's place in the pan-European security architecture, which, of course, is all kind of going back to the original thinking about security through the Helsinki process, which you've already brought up in this program. That's viable. I don't think that's going to change. It hasn't changed even after a year of conflict. George.
No, that's right. I mean, because what the Russians were seeking was some recognition from the West that what the West has been doing for 30 years, this NATO expansion, essentially creating this bloc, this military bloc that is clearly surrounding Russia and is targeted at Russia, that this cannot go on, that Russia just simply cannot accept a military alliance on its borders.
Well, particularly since that alliance has targeted Russia as their primary reason.
Exactly. They're explicit about it. They're explicit about it. And, you know, particularly when we've had the past decade of this constant barrage of anti-Russian propaganda, all the sanctions. The sanctions didn't start, you know, after the launch of the special military operation. We've had all the Magnitsky Act sanctions. We had all the sanctions about supposed Russian interference in U.S. elections. You know, there've been wave after wave of sanctions. And Russia sees this military alliance is moving towards our borders. You know, the one country that is our ally, Belarus, is the constant target of would-be color revolutions. They want us to be totally surrounded by NATO. And Russia said, we can't take this anymore. This is an absolutely existential threat for us. And, you know, the West's response was, we're not even going to talk about it. You know, Russia just isn't strong enough to dictate terms to us. Well, you know, this was the effect. And, you know, ultimately, you're absolutely right. Any kind of a negotiated outcome will have to recognize this. You can't, that NATO cannot go on as it's been doing, because there will be more wars and there'll be even more deadly wars.
Yeah, Alexander, George teed it up really well, because the West is obsessed with, again, it's ideologically obsessed, you know, democracy, autocracy, all of this kind of nonsense that they throw out. And then they talk about Ukraine's security and its relationship with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They're focused on Ukraine's borders, its security. But at the same token, they can't recognize that Russia has security interest as well. That's what's missing right here. And that is keeping any kind of settlement far out of reach, because up and until they recognize Russia has security interest, there's going to be no peace in Europe.
Yeah, I think Victoria Nuland also recently just admitted that the conflict in Ukraine is about destabilizing the Russian government and trying to remove Putin from power. So this, the talk about Ukraine and territorial integrity, that I would consider to be just wallpapering for their real motives, which are clear enough even before Nuland said anything about it, that it was all directed against Russia. So it seems that whatever portion of Ukraine is not taken under the control of Russia, that's going to effectively be part of NATO, whether it's admitted officially or not. In some sense, the Russian attempt to remove NATO from its borders through this war has failed, because now we do have a NATO army in Ukraine, and it's difficult to get figures on it, but there's up to 20,000 perhaps mercenaries, maybe 10,000 of them from Poland. The numbers vary all the time. So in that sense, Russia is going to have to, if they can't find a diplomatic solution that actually removes NATO from Ukraine, then they're going to have to keep going further and further west in order to achieve their goals of removing NATO's presence from that territory. However, I also wonder, you know, this is turning into a time issue for the U.S. It seems to me that Russia is able to continue this war indefinitely, while the U.S. seems to be running more on a schedule, because already the U.S. is stretched between the Ukraine front and the Taiwan front. Weapons manufacturers are several years behind deliveries, and Taiwan isn't getting the weapons that they have ordered. So the U.S. is getting stretched, and NATO partners and EU partners are not completely happy with the situation due to the economic issues that Germany has suffered, in particular with energy prices. The UK has been hit with energy prices going up, and this is all a result of the sanctions and the ongoing war in the Ukraine. And the US isn't letting its partners out of this situation. So it's putting pressure on NATO much more, I think, than it's putting pressure on Russia.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point, George. And I've always said that NATO was never designed actually to fight a war like this, a peer power. Okay, it was George and I are a bit older. It was always kind of a bit of a dinner club. Okay, it wasn't designed to actually be a military in a conventional sense. It was more political, and this is what they face. George, let's talk about the issue of denazification, because that's the second prong that has been never really been discussed much in the West. They just think it's frivolous. But you and I know exactly what that means. There has to be regime change. You cannot have the current regime still in power, okay? And that is something that the West is going to have to contend with, and certainly Mr. Zelensky is going to have to contend with, because we all know that anyone in Ukraine in power makes some kind of concession, large concessions, number of concessions, they're not going to be around much longer after they do that. I mean, we know that. Go ahead, George.
Yes, that's exactly it. I think Russia's goals, while they were limited back in last February, clearly now has to include regime change in Kyiv, because I cannot allow this Zelensky gang, this rabidly Russophobic crowd, to stay in power. I mean, what happens? Let's say there's an armistice, or there's some sort of a peace agreement. They will immediately start rearming. We know that's exactly what NATO is going to do. I mean, they're going to do what they did in 2014, and to restart this all over again in 5-10 years' time. So Russia has to make a drastic change. And I mean, and that's obvious. I mean, whenever America has fought its wars, America's always pursued regime change, you know, whether it's, regime change in Yugoslavia, regime change in Iraq. I mean, they publicly called for, you know, Bashar al-Assad has to go. I mean, it's ultimately that's how you win a war. You have to remove the source of your problems. And in this case, clearly, you know, this Zelensky, I mean, now they're coming with this new plan, which is that we won't call Russia Russia anymore. We'll just call it Muscovia. I mean, you can't allow this sort of hysterically, entity like this, which Bandera stand on your border. So regime change has to be the ultimate war objective.
Yeah, because Alexander, what is mystifying for me, I can understand the Zelensky's and his regime, their Russophobic attitude, because they have NATO at their back. They'll keep funding us. They'll keep protecting us. There's no downside for that. But the longer this goes on, the entire European security architecture is very unstable. It's very vulnerable. And of course, there are people like Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken. They have a very long history of wanting to see the end of the Russian Federation. This is, obvious stuff that you can learn. But, what about the people in the rest of Europe? I mean, this is not their crusade, okay? This is a crusade of elites, and a very specific group of elites. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I think it recently came out how in March last year, just after the Russian counterattacks in Donbas and in other parts of the Ukraine, Zelensky wanted to actually negotiate, and he was hoping to, you know, find a diplomatic solution to this right at the beginning. But the State Department came in and the U.S. handlers came in and said, no, you can't do that. We have a war to fight here. So it's quite clear that the Ukraine has become an apparatus of the State Department in the same way that the EU is as well. We all remember Nuland's call that was leaked where she was describing her disdain for the EU. And I think you can only do that if you have effective control over the organization. So that's the problem that Europe finds itself in. It's effectively a protectorate of the United States, regardless of what NATO may call itself or how it may brand itself. The EU finds itself in a protectorate position. So it doesn't have the ability to lead an independent policy, and that's been seen by Germany. Germany's interests are within tighter economic cooperation with Russia, and that's how we got the Nord Stream pipelines, and that's not in the interest of a U.S. protectorate, and that's how we got the Nord Stream pipelines destroyed, as Seymour Hersh came out with his studies of how that probably happened, and indicates that the U.S. was involved, which doesn't really surprise anybody. You know, you had Biden going out there saying, we're going to end it. And
Alexander, we're almost out of time. But George, you know, Sergeant Shultz, as we refer to him on this program, went to Washington, what, for like a day and a half, maybe less than that, a one-hour visit with the president of the United States. No press coverage, went back. So he was just given his marching orders, wasn't he? 30 seconds, George.
Right,
so
marching orders. Well, that's the thing. Europe's elite is not in any sense representative of Europe's interests. It's an American bought and paid for trained elite, and they represent openly America's interests.
Yep. Well, you ended the program almost exactly on time. One thing we're going to be definitely looking at, as it was mentioned here, is that this rapprochement of Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is very, very important. So viewers of Crosstalk will see that next week. As all the time, I want to thank our guests in St. Petersburg and in Budapest. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.